Last year, Oregon's legislature backed off a new law that would have ended non-medical exemptions for children getting vaccines. California showed no such qualms. In fact, the legislature passed a bill ending the non-medical exemptions for vaccines in California in the middle of 2015. And recently published research shows the legislation achieved the desired effect, higher vaccine rates up to the desired point of herd immunity. Seven authors put their names to the research. One of those authors joins us. Dr. Peter Hotez is professor of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology and Dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Dr. Hotez, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I have to commend you on a fairly fast turnaround. It seems like we often wait several years to get some numbers in cases like these. Tell us what the analysis focused on.
Well, the analysis really looked at this new policy that was implemented by the California legislature. You know what happened in California? There was a terrible measles epidemic in Orange County in 2014-2015, and that landed dozens of kids in the hospital. Some of them were very sick. You know, measles causes measles pneumonia, in some cases encephalitis. It's, you know, one of our most serious global health problems. 140,000 kids died last year from measles. So the fact that measles was back in California sent an alarm signal to the California legislature that things had gone too far in one direction, meaning that too many kids were not getting vaccinated in multiple pockets. Overall, if you looked at the state numbers, they were looking pretty good, but you had these pockets where a significant number of kids were denied their vaccines, and some schools where 10, 20, 30% of kids were not being vaccinated, and that's just a matter of time before you're going to start seeing measles. We tend to see measles faster than the other vaccine-preventable diseases because it's so highly contagious. It's like our biomarker for declines in vaccine coverage. So the California legislature took leadership and became one of the few states in our country to close all non-medical exemptions for vaccines. And we were curious to know, did it work? Did it have an impact? And the numbers that we found suggest, yes, that there was a that eliminating non-medical childhood vaccine exemptions was associated with an increase in vaccine coverage and a reduction in non-medical exemptions at the state and county level. There were some complications to it around fake medical exemptions that we could talk about, but overall it suggests that as a policy, closing non-medical exemptions in the state of California works. And then the next question is this unique to California, or would it be true of other states? Right now, of the 50 U.S. states, we only have a few states that have shut down non-medical exemptions. That's California, New York, Maine, West Virginia, and Mississippi. So not many states at all, but in California, it clearly was successful.
Now, did you track just the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or were there others?
No, I think other vaccines were looked at as well. And so, you know, really looking at all those school entry childhood vaccinations.
Okay. We are talking again with Dr. Peter Hotez from Baylor University, the one of the seven authors of a study showing that California's law banning non-medical exemptions for vaccines did result in a rise in vaccination rates in the state. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There was some mathematical modeling in the research here. Would you explain that, please?
I wish I could. That was led by Nathan Lowe, who's a brilliant mathematical modeler who was at Stanford, now is at UCSF. But he led looking at the modeling, and it's kind of a unique skill in terms of how you conduct mathematical modeling. So I was hoping he could join me today, but he was unable to. So I can't go into the weeds on how the modeling was done, but it's a pretty standard methodology that mathematical modelers use.
All right, but the essence of it was that you ended up having numbers in the research showing the vaccination rate without the law and what the actual rate turned out to be with the law.
That's right, comparing the two. And then, you know, this is a complicated policy because one of the problems with just slapping a law on the table is it doesn't win hearts and minds. And one of the things that I've been saying and talking about is if you only take the legislative approach and the legal approach. In the long run, I don't know how long that will be effective, because you could still have parents deciding that they're still concerned about vaccines, that they believe vaccines are unsafe, and they'll wind up homeschooling their kids or taking their kids out of the state. So I think one of the things that's really important in all of this is to not only look at legislative solutions, and this is being discussed now in the state of New Jersey, but also we have to really think about how we win hearts and minds, and I think we need to do a better job in the United States of countering the massive amount of misinformation that's out there, and really increasing our overall level of vaccine advocacy and awareness. I think those two go hand in hand.
Well, I was looking at your own advocacy of vaccines, and in fact, you wrote a book published a couple of years ago about your daughter's autism. The title could not be clearer: Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism. You've made yourself quite a target for the vaccine-resistant community, but so what are you doing to try to win hearts and minds?
Well, you know, I'm actually a laboratory investigator. I'm not a public policy person. I'm an MD PhD laboratory investigator who develops vaccines for poverty-related neglected diseases. I have a nonprofit institute in an academic health center called the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. And I like to say we'll make all the vaccines that the drug companies won't make, because they're for the poorest of the poor. Especially in low-income countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. But I also have a daughter with autism, and I'm a pediatrician scientist, and I was particularly alarmed by Texas, because we've not done the same thing in Texas as was done in California, and we've seen a steep rise in non-medical exemptions, over 64,000 kids not getting their vaccines, and that doesn't include any of the more than 300,000 homeschooled kids. So I looked at this and I said, what's going on here? And I think it's just a matter of time before we see the same measles epidemics in Texas that we're seeing in California in 2014 and 2015. And I thought, look, if anybody can talk about this, because I have a daughter with autism, because I know the science of vaccinology, I felt compelled to do it. And I like to write books, so this is not my first book, and wrote the book, and it's made an impact in terms of getting people to understand the massive amount of evidence showing that there's absolutely no link between vaccines and autism. And one of the things the anti-vaccine lobby does, it keeps moving the goalposts. At first they claimed it was the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine that causes autism, then they switched it up and said, no, we didn't mean the MMR vaccine, we meant the thimerosal preservative that's in vaccine. And then it came down to spacing vaccines too close together, then aluminum in vaccine. So we started playing this game of vaccine whack-a-mole, continuing to respond to that. So I summarize all of that evidence in the book, showing there's absolutely no link between any of those things and autism, because that's a central tenet of the anti-vaccine lobby, but also doing a deep dive and explaining what autism is and how we've learned so much about autism over the last decade or so, in terms of at least 100 genes involved in early fetal brain development. The point is, autism is a set of neurodevelopmental processes that begin in pregnancy well before kids ever see their vaccines. And what's more, So the point is, there's no plausibility even that vaccines would cause autism. And I didn't even talk about the fact that we did whole exome sequencing. We had all of our genome sequenced. I say we, I mean myself, my wife Ann, and Rachel, and we're able to identify a gene that's linked to autism that's similar to the other 100 genes that have been so identified. And I thought it would make an interesting book to both tell about the science, but in a very personal way, having now an adult daughter with autism, but also and it's not really the autism component that's so difficult. It's all the intellectual disabilities that in Rachel's case she has, and all the challenges of her finding employment, and what it means to be an adult on the autism spectrum, and looking for special services that are needed, and the complexities of that. And I thought that would make an important story to tell.
So having put that out there, I mean, has anybody contacted you and said, you finally convinced me, I'm going to get my kids vaccinated? Have you gotten anything like that?
Absolutely. Lots of great emails, or I'm on social media, I'm on Twitter, some great stuff. And in many cases, it's interesting, looking at two spouses in a marriage, one spouse is convinced vaccines cause autism, the other doesn't, and I get the letter from one of the spouses thanking me because he or she was able to, use those to convince the other spouse that vaccines are safe and don't cause autism and what the anti-vaccine lobby is all about. So that's been very gratifying. Having said that, as you point out, the anti-vaccine lobby likes to gang tackle, and it has been tough, right? I mean, they attacked the book. My poor book on Amazon has just gotten pummeled with one-star reviews with one-word reviews, so it's clear that in many cases they haven't even read the book. And some threatening emails and stalking at scientific conferences. So no question I've paid a price for this. But in the end, I think it's really important to get that public health message out there.
Peter Hotez is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a PhD, MD at the Baylor University College of Medicine in Houston, where he works on vaccines and tropical diseases. And you could join the conversation here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Back to California and the research that you were a part of here on showing that with the non-medical exemptions banned by law, that the rates did go up. Were there any particular surprises in what you saw in California's experience?
I think the one disappointment was the fact that this also led to a rise in medical exemptions, and we know that those medical exemptions can't be real, otherwise they would have been the same all along. So one of the things we've learned since then, after multiple investigations, not conducted by us but conducted by officials in California, is that closing those non-medical exemptions created a cottage industry of physicians and other healthcare professionals actually charging people money for fake medical exemptions. And now, so that actually required the California legislature to go back and actually implement additional legislation to require an extra layer of review on those medical exemptions, which is also, a wake-up call that this is probably going to have to be looked at in other states as well that choose to close down non-medical exemptions. You're going to have to tackle the phony cottage industry of medical exemptions. And as I keep on stressing, doing this alone is not going to win hearts and minds. You're going to have to really step up your advocacy, educate parents and the population on the importance of vaccinations, why they're life-saving, why they don't cause autism, or now all the other new things that the anti-vaccine lobby is alleging. Because after I wrote the book, slowly the anti-vaccine lobby now is pivoting away from autism, because they've so clearly lost that argument, and now they're resorting to all sorts of other crazy things like teenage suicide and depression, or autoimmune disease, or thromboembolic events, everything under the sun. So we still have our work cut out for us.
You mentioned the pockets of California where the vaccine non-medical exemptions were particularly high. Have those come up more or less within striking distance of the state average?
Yeah, things have been definitely better. And you make a very good point. One of the things if you look at the information that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention puts out, they only provide numbers for state-level medical exemptions. And almost every state, actually, ironically, with the exception of Oregon, that's actually one of the worst-performing states. But except for Oregon, most states look pretty good in terms of percentage of kids covered with vaccines. But clearly, our studies, this and other papers we've published in the Public Library of Science, show that only looking at state-level medical exemptions alone is a bit of a blunt instrument, because what happens is, while overall the state may look good, you have these hotspot areas, both urban and rural hotspots, where large numbers of kids are not getting vaccinated. And that's how measles works. Measles takes advantage of pockets of low vaccine coverage, and those are the places where you see measles outbreaks, like last year, the one in Vancouver, Washington, and then it went in across the river into parts of Portland. And that's where the problems are. So it's really important to focus on individual counties and even individual school districts or even schools when you can look at it. For instance, we now are looking at some of the schools in Texas where 10, 20, 30, even 40% of kids are not vaccinated, and that's just a setup for breakthrough measles epidemics. And what happens there is when there's an outbreak in the school, you could say, okay, but the other vaccinated kids are covered. But the problem is, you know, those kids then go home and play with siblings, and it's the infants under the age of 12 months, not yet old enough to get vaccinated. Those are the vulnerable ones. Those are the ones who wind up with measles pneumonia, measles encephalitis, and hospitalized. Like we saw in New York City this past year, where there were 600 measles cases and 50 hospitalizations, including 16 in the intensive care unit. And most of those really sick kids were the infants. So those are the ones we really need to protect.
Peter, we have about 2 minutes left here, and I just wanted to ask, you're talking about needing to win hearts and minds in addition to using the blunt force instrument of passing laws like California did. And the one thing I seem to hear most, even from people who are sort of on the line about vaccines, is like, well, there's so many and they're so close together. Is there anything being done wrong in the medical delivery of vaccines in either quantity or speed?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the new vaccines that have come online, they are really for diseases that are having terrible public health impact. Let me give you an example. When I was a pediatric house officer, a resident in Boston at Massachusetts General Hospital, I was admitting a kid every couple of weeks with what's called HIB, H-I-B, B as in boy, Haemophilus influenza type B meningitis. It's a terrible disease that causes permanent neurologic injury, death, deafness. It's a devastating disease for families and even for the pediatric house officers who are taking care of those kids. The vaccine came online in 1989, and now it's a disease I talk about purely for historic interest. It's a disease that's been eradicated from the United States. So, again, that's an example of a disease where I was admitting kids to the hospital every couple of weeks, and now it's gone. And if you look at all of the new vaccines that have come online like that for pneumococcal pneumonia and meningitis, also a devastating disease, and some of the others, there is actually a pretty high bar for getting new vaccines added. And when possible, those vaccines are combined in a single shot, so it's not like you're getting that many injections, and they are life-saving. And as a result, the U.S. is one of the most robust and safest vaccine systems in the country.
All right. We've gotten quite a tour of vaccine theory from Dr. Peter Hotez at Baylor University, who was one of the seven authors of a study on California's policy eliminating non-medical vaccine exemptions passed by the legislature in 2015. Peter, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.